The committee will come to order. We don't have quorum yet, but we are going to begin today by hearing a presentation by the insurance industry on long-term care insurance products in Minnesota and the challenges that the industry is currently facing. We'll also be hearing a presentation from the Department of Human Services on their Own Your Future initiative. First up, we have Robin Rowan.
That was my cue. Okay.
Yes. So please introduce yourself for the record and begin your presentation.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. I'm Robin Rowan. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Insurance and Financial Services Council. MIFSI members provide financial security through the sale of life and long-term care insurance, annuities, mutual funds, and other retirement products like 401ks. MIFSI members support 65,000 jobs in Minnesota, not including the agents that distribute our products all over the state. First, I'd like to thank the committee for the opportunity to talk to you today about long-term care insurance. This might shock you, but we don't get a lot of invitations to come talk about insurance, so we're very excited to be here to talk about long-term care. I thought I would start out with a scary statistic because that's what we do when we talk about our aging society. So the statistic I have today is that about 70% of people who reach age 65 are expected to need some kind of long-term care, and only a fraction of those know how they are going to pay for that care. While long-term care insurance is not the silver bullet to the challenges that the silver tsunami present, or whatever you want to call it, to our society, it's an important part of the solution. The benefits are clear. Long-term care insurance provides a way for people to take personal responsibility for their long-term care needs and not rely on the taxpayers. It allows people to preserve assets for the next generation, avoid burdening family members with their care, and to control the care that they receive, where and how it's given. But despite the obvious benefits, long-term care insurance can be a challenging product to sell. Recent studies have shown that people would rather discuss religion and politics with family than plan for a long-term illness. People still think the government or Medicare will cover their long-term care needs, and the cost of the product has also discouraged people from purchasing it. It can be an even harder product to price. The challenge is that people buy the product in their 50s, and they don't use it for 30 years. A lot can change in 30 years. When the product was created in the late 70s and early 80s, it was before the advent of assisted living and the prolific rise in Alzheimer's cases. Evidence of these challenges can be seen in the fact that in the 80s, there were over 100 carriers that sold long-term care insurance, but now there are 12 carriers. The good news is that the companies that are in the market are committed to it, and the product is undergoing a kind of renaissance right now in what it covers and how it's sold. I have here with me today Deb Newman, who's the founder and president of Newman Long-Term Care and a true expert in the field. You might have heard her on NPR this morning on the way in today. And also Rick Clevin, who's the vice president of government affairs with Thriven, and they're going to talk about the product itself and the market. And then because I want to save the juiciest part for the end, with any remaining time, I'll talk about how the product is regulated when they're done.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Rowan.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Deb Newman with Newman Long-Term Care. And members of the committee, it's a delight to be here, an honor to be here. A little nervous, actually. Never done this before. So I want to start back talking about the origin of long-term care so you understand the metamorphosis that's happened. Back in the 70s, it was nursing home insurance, and what that was meant to be a supplement to Medicare. Medicare had a three-day hospital stay, and if you were in the hospital 3 days and transferred to a facility, Medicare would pay for up to 20 days, and then with the coinsurance up to 100. So the initial policies had that same language, a three-day hospital stay, and then they would start at the 20th day or the 100th day and continue for some period of time. So that's how it started, and it really was nursing home insurance. And so then in the late 80s, our regulations changed it significantly and turned it into what was the beginning of long-term care insurance. It got rid of the three-day hospital stay and then also added home health care as a feature. And normally it was like $100 a day for nursing home, $50 a day for home health care, and that was how it was built for probably half a dozen years. In the early 90s, it changed to what we currently have, which is comprehensive long-term care insurance. And now the policies pay for assisted living, nursing home, home care, adult daycare, however our care might be delivered. They're that comprehensive. That started probably in somewhere around 1992. Then in 1997, we had the HIPAA legislation, which allowed for long-term care insurance to become a deductible expense and the benefit to be tax-free, and therefore the government put more regulation on the industry in terms of the language as to how you qualified for benefits. So the good news with that is the tax benefits and also the standardization of the policies really across the country. That started probably right around 1997. And so that's the current state of affairs that we're working with. And so when we started this, and I've been doing long-term care insurance, my firm focusing exclusively on long-term care insurance, we are celebrating our 25th year this year. So I've been doing this a long time. And in the beginning, when the people that we talked to were in their 70s because it was a coordination with Medicare. But today, we're talking to people in their 50s. The average age of people buying long-term care insurance is 57. We also do a lot of worksite enrollment where we do employer plans and voluntary plans where employees buy benefits. And that average age is actually 45. So it's turned now from closer to the need to a planning tool. And that's where we are right now. What I want to share with you just real quickly is how a long-term care policy is built. There's really only four decisions a consumer has to make to design a long-term care policy. I think we tend to think this is more complicated. It's pretty simple. The first decision is a monthly benefit. So you look at the cost of care out in our communities, and you might say, gosh, a nursing home costs $7,000 a month, but home care might only be $4,000 a month. So you buy this monthly benefit based on cost today. And that's the first decision you make. You make a decision as to how much of that risk you want to insure. The second decision is how long will the benefit pay? And you can buy a benefit that would pay for 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, 5 years, 10 years. That's actually one of the advantages of Thrivent, that they have probably one of the most comprehensive policies in the marketplace. And so you pick this maximum benefit. The third decision is an elimination period, which you might consider kind of a deductible, and that goes back, remember when I talked about Medicare with the 20 and 100 days? So we still have a deductible or period of time where you have to pay for your own care before the policy kicks in. The prevalent one that most people pick is 90 days. And the final decision to build a policy is some sort of an inflation feature, because we are buying this in our 50s, and hopefully we won't use it till 30 years later, and in my case, 40. And so we want to have some sort of inflation protection on there to make sure that it keeps up with the costs of care in the future. There's one other component that we will typically add to a policy, and that is called a shared care benefit, because none of us know if we have a partner in our life, if both of us will need care, one of us will need care, we don't know for how long. So if we each buy a three-year bucket of money, a three-year benefit, we can connect the buckets and essentially together have a six-year benefit bucket. And so we can share that. If one person didn't use theirs, then the other person can have the full 6 years, or however it might work out, you have 6 years between the two people. And so that's essentially all there is to designing a long-term care policy. The tax benefits are phenomenal. As I said in 97, with the HIPAA legislation, we can businesses can deduct it as a benefit for their employees. And if you're self-employed, you can deduct part of the premium as a benefit to yourself and your family as well as your employees. And we have a tax credit in Minnesota. And the tax credit has been around since 1999. It's $100. And you might say, well, gosh, that's not significant, and I wish it was higher, but I will tell you that in the worksite marketplace, the premiums might really only be $600 or $700 a piece, so $100 is significant for people to be able to take advantage of that tax credit. The other thing I just want to share with you is that over the 25 years I've been talking about long-term care planning, there's a chart that shows in our nation, who's paying for long-term care? And our government, 25 years ago, was paying for 67% of care through Medicare and Medicaid. 67% of all the care that's paid is paid for by Medicare and Medicaid. And in those days, 2% was being paid for by long-term care insurance or nursing home insurance. Today, 67% is still being paid by Medicare and Medicaid, but insurance is now paying for 12% of care. And I think that's pretty impressive, considering that you have to be healthy to buy the insurance, so there has to be some time lag before the policies actually start paying, and we're now up to 12% of the pie is being paid for by long-term care insurance, and I think that's something noteworthy for us to understand. And I just want to end with a story that talks about care. It happened right here in Minnesota. It was in northern Minnesota. And a lot of people will say, you know, families provide care. And in our nation and in our state, families are the unpaid, if you will, part of this equation. And so this mother and daughter had made an agreement, and the mother asked her daughter, because she was a nurse, would you care for me when I need care? And she had some other brothers and sisters, but the mom said, if you'll care for me, I will then give you the house and the assets that I have. And so the daughter said, Mom, I'll do that for you for sure. And so years went by, and then finally Mom needed care. The daughter moved up to northern Minnesota to start caring for her mom. And 6 months into the care, she discovered she couldn't provide the level of care that her mom needed. So she ended up having her mom get professional care, and she started having to use the assets that her mom had, and then she had to sell the home to pay for the care. And then 2 years later, when her mom died, she'd lost her mom, and she'd also lost all the assets that were promised to her in this agreement to do this caregiving. And so the message when I'm talking to people about long-term care is somebody is going to care for you. That's going to happen. Somebody is going to care. Somebody's going to be the safety net. Somebody's going to deliver that care. But it's really, what are we doing to our families and those caregivers in our lives that end up with that burden and that care? And I'm not saying that people don't willingly do that, but caregiving destroys the health of the healthy caregiver. And so by having long-term care insurance in place in those families, it gives them permission to hire somebody to deliver the care so that the family unit can stay the family and the care can be provided in a professional way so that the family can preserve their own health. And so today, it's let's have a discussion with our families. That's probably one of the most important things about how we're going to deal with this if, in fact, 70% of us are going to need care. We've got to have a plan for it. And so if you have a plan in place, nobody minds spending insurance dollars. But I will tell you, people really do not like to write big checks out of their checkbook, and so they don't, and then it falls on the family. So, you know, that's really the story and the evolution, if you will, of what's going on with long-term care. Did I miss anything? Oh, yeah, and so one of the issues today is everybody talks about, well, that's all great, but this insurance is so expensive. In fact, I was on NPR this morning, and, of course, the question was, wow, it's so expensive. And one of the companies that's done more business than anybody in the world, quite frankly, just did a deep, deep, deep dive into all of their claims experience. And what they determined was that people, remember I talked about that monthly benefit? People are only using 67% of their monthly benefit. Now, that doesn't mean that they're not getting quality care or anything. What it means to me is that they bought too much. They bought insurance anticipating the huge risk of the nursing home, but they're only receiving care at home, which is where they want to receive care, or in assisted living. And so one of the things that I'm doing as I go out and talk to people is to say, let's insure for where care is being delivered. And 70% of care is being on the claims data, 70% is either assisted living or home care. So let's insure for that risk. And let's get it down to an affordable premium that people can afford. And that if you need nursing home care, you've got 70% of it paid for. So you'd like have a 70% off coupon for that care if you need care at that level. But in the meantime, you've got enough care to deliver your care at home or in the nursing home. And when we do that, there's been studies done, Forbes has done studies saying what is the amount that people are willing to pay for premiums. And when we get it down to that amount, there's a 300%. What they did is they said, would you pay $4,500 for long-term care insurance for a couple? And 13% of people said, yeah, we do that. What if it was $100 a month per person or $2,400? How many of you would do it? And it turned into like 35% of the people said that they would buy long-term care insurance. So what we have to do is drive the premium down to those ranges. We can do that. We just need to be packaging it with existing policies that already exist in a way that gets the premium down there. And we can already do that with what we've got. So it's a paradigm shift, as you said, kind of a renaissance, a different way of thinking about how to solve this. But we've got the solutions already in place. There's wonderful tax benefits, and I think we just have to have more conversations about it.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Newman. It's pretty clear why you're so successful at selling long-term care insurance policies.
I know. I just passed her a note trying to buy some.
While you were speaking, we did get quorum, so I'll officially call the meeting to order. And I had one question for you, if you would, Ms. Newman. When you were talking about the average age of people who are buying long-term care insurance, you talked about how it's the average age is 57 for people buying it on their own, but 45 if they're buying it through their employer, through an employer group. Do you think that's associated with the cost of the premium, since you said the one for the employer is lower, or because they're having the conversation earlier?
It's probably both, but I think that because there's a conversation happening at that employer, and they're seeing that the employer is recommending it, and so there's much more participation then. And so, and the average age in the employer groups is around 45. So that's as much as anything.
Okay. Okay, thank you. We do have a couple of questions from members as well. Representative Liebling.
Thanks, Mr. Chair, and thank you very much for your presentation. I understand that there's something in some long-term care policies called a discretionary clause that insurance companies can use to deny the claims of people who have these policies, and that it's pretty much not reviewable. I don't know a ton about long-term care insurance, but you look puzzled, so maybe that doesn't ring a bell, but I understand that Minnesota's one of only a few states that permits these discretionary clauses, and that sometimes people don't get the benefit of their policies because of this.
Ms. Newman.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Liebling, I will tell you the reason for the puzzled look is I really don't know. I'm not familiar with that. Some policies actually have a way of paying additional benefits. So in other words, if the person, it didn't fit for assisted living or nursing home or home health care, there's maybe robotics or something that emerges later, they often have a clause that says if there's an emerging benefit, we will consider paying that. I mean, that's the only thing that I can think that sounds like a discretionary kind of a term that I've seen in policies.
Representative Liebling?
Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Representative Yaruso.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, just a comment on your question a moment ago. When you have the benefit available through your employer, you get a look at the fact that the premiums are much lower if you get in earlier. And I think if people don't think about it on their own, they're assuming it's expensive, and so they hold it off. They don't find that out.
Thank you, Representative Yaruso. Representative Tice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Ms. Newman. I haven't heard you say anything about hospice care. And when you purchase long-term, I guess I want you to say something about hospice care and how that fits into.
Ms. Newman.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Tice. Thank you. My own stepdad spent 7 months in hospice, and his long-term care policy paid for it fully. So long-term care also includes both facility hospice and home hospice at the same level it would pay for anything else. Thank you.
Okay, Representative Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Comparing it to life insurance, you kind of have term insurance, you have whole insurance. What you're talking about is kind of a term insurance sort of policy, correct? Is there any model or is there any opportunity for some sort of whole life? I mean, using that as the comparison, any sort of whole long-term?
Ms. Newman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Miller. Yes, I mean, I'll share with you two things. One is that in a traditional long-term care policy that I described, there's no cash value, if that's what you're talking about, so that it's more like the traditional insurance, like homeowners or whatever, where you pay for it and you use the benefit or you don't. But I will share one thing that's unique about long-term care insurance, and that is that the premium is waived when you go on claim. There's no other insurance that I know of that waives the premium actually when you go on claim. It's really a unique benefit of that, so it kind of has a paid-up aspect of it. Sure. But there are products in the marketplace that are actually life insurance with long-term care riders. And so you actually can combine those solutions in one policy, and that is emerging in the marketplace really robustly. So there's a lot of choices in the marketplace that allow for that.
Representative Miller. Ms. Rowan.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Miller, I also wanted to add that the industry would actually like to have a cash benefit similar to a whole life policy that we could give back if the policy wasn't used. But on the federal level, HIPAA prevents us from doing that because when they first took on long-term care insurance, they didn't want it to be used as a savings account. I mean, similar restrictions to your IRA, you just can't take it out for any reason. So we are working on the federal level to be able to change that.
Thank you. Representative Rosenthal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just have a quick question. Obviously, it's better to start paying early when we're younger and it's cheaper. And as we start to age, with taking inflation out of the picture, as we come closer to needing those benefits, do the rates change? And if so, by how much as you approach the age when we might need those benefits?
Mr. Chairman, and Representative Rosenthal, the premiums, this is insurance, the category is guaranteed renewable, which means that no matter what, you can renew your premium regardless of your health or anything else, so that's guaranteed. But the insurance industry does have the right to raise premiums if their claims exceed what they anticipated in pricing. And so we've seen a fair amount of that over the years because of the evolution of the product. But now I think with the pricing that we're doing right now with 99% persistency built in, a low interest environment built in, high life expectancy built in, high claims built in, that I think the pricing is much more stable now than it has been historically. So it doesn't automatically go up at age, but there is a risk that can still happen.
Representative Rosenthal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm asking this because I'm working with a constituent right now who was paying $400-some-odd a month and was auto-renewed, is now paying $1,800 a month.
Oh.
And that seems to me quite a jump. That's the first part of my question. The second part is, if you decide to go the option of home health care or assisted living and you don't use those benefits, can they then be applied to nursing home or other types of care?
Ms. Newman.
Thank you. So Representative Rosenthal. Yes, if it's a comprehensive long-term care policy, the ones I described that cover home care, assisted living, and nursing home, they would allow for the benefit to be paid under any of those circumstances. So if you bought a policy, as I indicated, if you bought one at a level of $4,000 a month, anticipating you would use it for home care, then yes, you can apply that benefit to nursing home. It just wouldn't be as comprehensive. And the other circumstance that you described with that premium, I must say I have never witnessed a premium that we've written 20,000 policies, and I have never witnessed a policy go up that amount. In fact, there is even protection built into the policies that they cannot go up that extreme. I, I'm thinking there's something else going on there, which I would love to visit with you about.
All right. Representative Yaruso.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We all think about these plans as covering us in our older age. Do you have any numbers on people that end up making claims, because we could all have an accident and an injury or a health event at a younger age? So how often do people end up being able to use these benefits? Any feel for that?
We could get you some information.
And Representative Bruce, I will tell you that when you buy it, if whatever age you buy it, you can go on claim the next day.
Yeah.
So that it is available to you immediately, but I don't have any statistics on that. And we all think of this as old age, but there are a lot of people that have accidents. We've had motorcycle accidents, hunting accidents, where people have ended up on claim as a result of those things.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Newman. And next we have Mr. Clavin.
I think you can hear me. That's usually not an issue. I'll be brief. Hi, Rick, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Rick Clavin. I'm Vice President of Government Affairs at Thrivent. Some still don't know who Thrivent is. We are the merger of Lutheran Brotherhood, a Minneapolis company, and Aid Association for Lutherans. We are probably the only local carrier that's currently offering long-term care in terms of, having our Minnesota base here. We're fraternal. Our purposes go beyond financial security, but I think for long-term care purposes, we're probably regulated pretty much the same. Really appreciate you looking at this topic. It's something we've been vitally concerned about and believe in for a long time. We are one of the first to offer long-term care insurance. It was back in the 1980s. Didn't sell a lot at first, but we saw our product begin to be very interested by our membership in the 1990s. We sold quite a few policies in Minnesota and other places nationally. But as things developed, in 2003, we decided to get out of the market. We found it very difficult to offer a competitive product. Interest rates had gone down, and this is a new product. And even though it's 30, 40 years, we didn't have a lot of data at the time. And as we looked at the data and the predictions we'd made, we just didn't feel like competitively we could offer this as much as we believed in it. So we made the tough decision to get out of that market. I don't know if we were lucky or smart, because I think that was a difficult time for long-term care insurers, but we still believed in it. We have our own field representatives, Thrivent does. They're probably in your hometown. We still believe in it, so we made some contracts with some of the other carriers and continued to offer long-term care insurance to the people we were serving. Like I said, we got out of it in 2003. In 2012, to the puzzlement of many, including my friends in the industry, we got back into the long-term care insurance market about 2 years ago. It may seem counterintuitive, but one of the reasons we did it was everybody else was getting out. And a large part of that decision was we felt like people needed this insurance. And a lot of the people we served, the membership we served was aging. We felt like at the time we could do this as well or better as others that were serving our members. We knew more. There was more data out there over time. You start to learn about your population. You start to learn about what's going to happen in the marketplace. And the products have evolved. And Ms. Newman talked about that a little bit. For us, it was a very member-driven decision. Our membership owns us. But again, our product had to be viable. We can't just give the contracts away. We've been in it about 2.5 years. We get the question a lot, and we really, really welcome this discussion today. Thank you for it. We're getting a solid response from membership on the product, about what we expected. One barrier is misconceptions. It's a very misunderstood form of insurance. Our field is well-trained on it. But even there, as much as people should buy the coverage they can get and what they can afford, sometimes adding a lot of things to coverage scares people away because of the expense, even though they may need it. So we really are believers in trying to make it affordable and trying to get the folks that we serve to buy the basic coverage they need. And middle-income people really need it, and that tends to be, in our case, who we serve. I just wanted to give you a little bit about kind of our history on it. We're a very big believer in it. I hope you see us, and we also belong to Robin's group, as partners. We're a very big believer in long-term care insurance, and we applaud the efforts you're making here in looking at this and the Own Your Future group that is going to be speaking next. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Clevin and Ms. Newman and Ms. Rowan, for your presentation today. Are there any final remarks, Ms. Rowan?
Yeah, I just wanted to spend, if there's time, Mr. Chair, just a couple minutes. How many?
Moments
on the regulation of the product, because one thing that hasn't changed over time is how regulated the sale of the product is. Agents who sell the product have to take an intensive training course, and then they have to renew that training every year. We also can't sell a policy to anybody unless it's suitable for their individual circumstances, meaning their personal finances and their assets and their goals. A sale that isn't suitable is not a legal sale. There's also a 30-day free look period, so after you buy it, you have 30 days to return it and get all of the premiums that you spent back. I often wish I had that option for some of my unfortunate shoe purchases. In addition to that, as you said, it's guarantee renewable, which means, and we can't raise rates for individual health circumstances. But I did want to just spend my last moments to the rate increase issue. One of the things that regulators and industry misjudged when we started this product in the late 70s was how many people hold on to it and don't drop it. It's a good thing, but it was very unexpected. No one ever drops their long-term care insurance. And so the policies in the early sets in the late 70s and early 80s were very underpriced. And so what has happened is that there have been increases, significant increases on policyholders in those older books. And no one likes rate increases. Companies hate to ask for them. Regulators hate to give them because you can't do them without approval of the Commerce Department. And obviously consumers hate to pay them. But partnering with regulators, what companies do is put in place a number of protections for consumers that have those policies. For example, they work with policyholders to adjust the benefit. If you're 80 years old and you have a 5% inflation protection waiver rider, you don't need that anymore, obviously, so you can adjust the riders and the benefits so that the policy is affordable. If you can't afford it, regardless of what the adjustments the company can make, then you get a paid, in the vast majority of cases, you get a paid up benefit equal to the premiums you have paid in, so that you don't walk away with nothing if you have to drop it. And even given those circumstances and the rate increases, only 1-2% of people still drop it even in those circumstances. And there's good news here too, which is that we've gotten a lot smarter. This is a new product. Life mortality tables started in the 1630s. So this is just a baby product, but we've gotten a lot smarter about how to write it. Regulators have gotten a lot smarter about how to regulate it. There's a new law put in place that tightens the assumptions that we're required to make when we price it initially and makes it tougher to get rate increases on the other end. So we're fairly confident that the worst of that is behind us, but it's important to point out that because of the nature of this product, a very stable regulatory environment is really important for us to be able to grow the product and to innovate the product. Is that fast enough? Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Ronan. Thank you for your presentation today. Next, we have Commissioner Jessen and Ms. Gvenvold to talk about the Own Your Future campaign. And as we're changing at the tables, I believe Representative Miller has a guest that he would like to introduce.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Yes, my son Josh is able to come and visit with me for a couple days. He was not able to come in the beginning of session, so he's out here today. He's sitting up there. He's part of the Minnesota National Guard with an artillery unit out of Madison. So thanks for coming, Josh.
Thank you, Representative Miller. Thank you, Josh. All right. Please introduce yourself for the record and begin.
My name is Lucinda Jessen. I'm Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Human Services.
And I'm Gail Kvenvold, President of Leading Age Minnesota.
All right. Go ahead.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair, members, for having us here today. I'm going to try and explain a bit about the state's Own Your Future campaign, why we started it, what it's about. And Gail is really leading up one of the key parts of it, including the looking at other products. And so she's going to go in a little more detail through that. Let me just say a bit about why we started this. When I started as commissioner, it's hard to believe that was, you know, over 4 years ago. And a reporter asked me in my first week, what do you want to accomplish? One of the things I said, to the surprise of many, was I wanted to start to get more people to plan for long-term care. And I thought about this, you know, from some of the reasons, you know, you just heard about, Minnesota's aging. That's good. We're living longer. We're going to need more help as we live longer. And as we're aging, you have more people over the age of 65. We have fewer to support them. So we're going to have fewer caregivers that we all rely on so much. And as you heard, most people aren't prepared. Most of us, 70% of us, you just heard that, are going to need long-term care at some point in our lives, and most of us aren't ready for it. We aren't prepared, or we think Medicare is going to pay for it, and for the most part, it doesn't. And so people end up in the situation where their only option at some point may be to financially devastate themselves and qualify for our Medicaid program. I'm a huge believer in our Medicaid program, but it should be there for people who need it, but probably not for someone like me who maybe just isn't planning as well as he or she should. So we wanted to have people start those conversations. It's not just about finances. Not just, if I can share one personal story, this is a few years ago. I was sitting on the back porch of my parents' house with them. They were about 78, 79 then. They live in Fort Smith, Arkansas. And I thought, I just said, Mom, Dad, what are you thinking about long-term care? What is your plan? And he looked at me and said, Cindy, you are a plan for long-term care. And I just, fortunately, I have some sisters. But I thought, I don't want to be doing this with my four kids. So we had a lot of help. We put together an advisory panel with everyone from some of the people you all just heard from to AARP and a lot of consumer groups just saying, how do we go about this? So a couple of these slides I'll just quickly go through. I think some of you know this. By 2020, we're going to have more people over 65 than school-aged children. And that's the demographics that's a real challenge for our state on a lot of levels. And most of them, they tell us, don't know how they're going to pay for long-term care. And if you actually look at the third line down, the government program, I think a lot of those people believe a government program will cover it when we know that Medicare doesn't pay for most of long-term care. And we've done a lot in the first and the last few years to talk about how we want to have better services and savings and have more options available in our Reform 2020 initiative. But this is really our Own Your Own Future campaign, is trying to think about the financing side of long-term care. So one of the first things we did was, and we started this in 2012, was we started a public awareness campaign. The governor sent letters to, I think it was between 40 and 65, everyone in Minnesota between 40 and 65, encouraging them to have those conversations with their family and start planning. We developed a website that's a tool. It's not a place that's going to sell you anything, but it has a lot of good checklists. We also have, I have a copy if any of y'all want them, we've got a lot more of a book too for those of us who aren't as good at websites, where you can go and have checklists. If you're 30 to 40, here's what you should be thinking about. If you're 40 to 50, here's what you're thinking about. If you're a caregiver, here's some things to think about. So people would start at least making their own plan. But a lot of states had done similar things in the past, but no other state is taking the next two steps that we said we wanted to do as part of our campaign. We not only wanted to make it public awareness, but we realized for middle-income Minnesotans, we can make them aware, but unless there are more options that they know about, how are they going to make the financial part of their plan? So we thought we need to look at what's out there and what are additional things that might be out there that are actually affordable long-term care products for those who really need them, those middle-income Minnesotans. And then our third part, which we haven't gotten to quite yet, but we're going to hopefully launch this year, is let's look at our Medicaid program, our medical assistance program, and see if there are more incentives that we can build into it. We know we'd have to get permission from the federal government and all that. So if people save more for their long-term care, there are more incentives in our Medicaid program to do that. Maybe they're able to leave more money to their spouse or more property. If they at least have a financial plan, an insurance product, where they save for some of their long-term care. So maybe, Gail, I'll turn it over to you. Gail headed up this panel of our second phase looking at these options. And Gail, I just want to thank Gail so much. She has done a great job leading these efforts.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you, Commissioner. I am here in my capacity as chair of the subgroup of the advisory committee that was charged with taking a look at basically inventorying the financial tools and options that could encourage people to save and plan ahead for their long-term care. And we met once a month for a year and really went to school on the array of options that are available in Minnesota. And our goal was to identify the options that seemed to have the most promise for further development. And we were helped in this work not only by the Department of Human Services, but also the Department of Commerce, the Department of Revenue, the Department of Health, consumer stakeholders, industry experts, you heard from several of them just a moment ago, the business community and others as well. And we made a point of keeping abreast also of activity that's going on at the national level, a renewed interest in this area of how we can plan ahead and bring more private savings to bear on our long-term care financing challenge. As the commissioner noted, our particular focus was on middle-income Minnesotans. We met with the state demographer, and through that work, we arrived at defining middle income for this purpose as families that had an income between $50,000 and $125,000 a year. And I would note that although this was our target group, any work that we do to help this group plan ahead is going to benefit other groups in Minnesota as well. So after we did our work of trying to better understand the options that are available, we ended up identifying five broad strategies that we felt show promise in terms of encouraging people to plan ahead and save for their long-term care. And I'll touch on them just very, very quickly. The first was stimulating the long-term care insurance marketplace. And you heard a great deal about this already this morning. Ms. Newman referred to the paradigm shift in terms of restructuring these products in a way that would bring a younger person into the market and more people into the market to buy this product as well. This is really on simplifying and streamlining the benefit structure and offering them at a more affordable premium. Sometimes we call these policies short and fat, and that refers to the fact that you've got a robust benefit, but it's for a shorter duration. You might, for example, buy a policy that covered transitional care. We know that lengths of stay for most people in a care center are much shorter than they once were. Could you buy a policy that covered a short-term exposure to a risk of a nursing home stay? Could you buy a starter long-term care insurance policy? At a younger age, you add to it as you grow older. Could you structure a policy that was really catastrophic coverage with a large front-end deductible, but then significant coverage after a period of time in your life? The second broad area of strategy was looking at legislative and regulatory changes that could be made that would either allow greater penetration in the marketplace by these products or bring new products to market. And in a moment, I'll talk about one area we think has particular promise. We also then looked at a long-term care benefit that could be added to supplemental Medicare insurance. And this really was thinking about the person who has not planned ahead at all, but they get to age 65, and they're probably going to buy a supplemental insurance policy. Is there a way of adding a long-term care benefit at that point for those who haven't planned ahead? And the fourth broad strategy was really looking at home equity. And we know that for many Minnesotans, home equity is their savings plan. So how can you safely access those savings for long-term care? And then finally, we looked at options that would incent the use of tax-favored savings, something we know you're going to talk about yet this morning. So what you see before you here is the grid that we laid out that looked at these five strategy areas and then identified 15 initial proposals that we felt had promise for further development and exploration. Some of these are just ideas. Some of them are more well-developed than others, and we don't have time this morning to go into detail on them, but there is more detail available in the final report that we prepared for the advisory committee. I do want to highlight a couple of overarching recommendations of the subgroup and then two areas where specific work is unfolding. In the course of our work, we heard over and over again from consumers about the complexity in this issue area, and that led us to recommend to the advisory committee the establishment of a long-term care information and education center. a help center, if you will, focused on our risks for long-term care, the products and options that would help us cover that risk. And this would be both telephonic support, telephone support, as well as an interactive website. And this is one of the items that is included in the governor's budget proposals this year. Secondly, and you heard this already this morning, we know that the employer is a key to educating us at a younger age about our need for long-term care planning. And so we have recommended generally stronger partnerships in that arena. And finally, we also know that we have additional work to do to get consumer feedback on some of the ideas that we put forward, test consumer perception and take up on some of these products. So, to highlight two areas where there is work that is ongoing, in the course of our work, we became excited about something that was identified in a question here just a moment ago, and that's a new insurance product that we're calling Life Stage Planning. And it's a product concept that merges term life insurance, not whole life insurance, but term life insurance with a long-term care benefit. And basically, this concept merges the two so that at our younger ages, this is a life insurance benefit, but at age 65, it converts and becomes a long-term care benefit. We don't think it exists in quite the form that we're contemplating yet in the marketplace, but it would help address the fact that we really don't think about buying long-term care until we're closer to needing it. But we often buy life insurance at a younger age to protect our families and help our kids get through college if something happened to us. So if the same product could serve both needs, we think it could be something of a game changer in terms of bringing new people into the long-term care insurance market. Some preliminary actuarial work has been done on this, and although there is much more work to be done in terms of working with carriers and further actuarial work, the early indications is that this could be offered at a very affordable premium, basically a few hundred dollars a year for a person who's 45. So again, a promising new idea in the marketplace. Secondly, I mentioned that we continue to explore the idea of folding a long-term care benefit into a Medicare supplemental policy. Early work on that indicates it would most likely be a home health benefit. But another big idea that the group identified is combining the existing benefits under Medicare, the home health, the nursing home, the hospice benefit, in a new way that would allow more flexible use that reflects how life really unfolds today. We know nursing home stays are shorter. We know home care is the preferred way that people receive services. If you could take those currently siloed benefits and combine them in a new and more flexible way, that could be a game changer too. But obviously that will involve a lot more than our state level task force in order to accomplish this. In closing, just a few comments. So new thinking about benefit structures and the impact that could have on affordability was really key to our work, alongside the concept of making saving as easy and natural as possible. Using a life planning approach to designing solutions is also at the heart of our work. And by that, I mean looking at the times in our life when we are doing financial planning and looking to fold long-term care planning into that. Strong and understandable consumer protections guided all of our thinking alongside consumer education. We've tried to build on good work that has already been done in our state and work that is being done at the national level. And I would just add that as a state, we really are out in front in terms of thinking about long-term care financing reform. We can be very proud of our long-range view on solutions for this area. And then last point, that buy-in, both literally and figuratively by a younger generation, was uppermost in our minds throughout this work. You don't want to wait until you're my age to think about long-term care insurance or long-term care savings. And in our ideal future, thinking about our long-term care savings account would be as natural as thinking about our 401k or other retirement planning. And so I will pause there and thank the committee for their interest in this area.
Ms. Kvenvold, Ms. Commissioner Jessen, thank you for your presentation. Are there questions from the members for the presentation? Representative Newton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Kvenvold, did you look at means to hold down the increase in cost of care? When you're looking at, how we can pay for it, But what about the increasing costs of the care?
Ms. Convenvold.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Newton, we did not expressly look at strategies to contain costs in long-term care. We did spend some time at the very beginning of our work, though, looking at what it costs today in both nursing home settings, assisted living, and home care settings, and tried to build that into our planning. But we did not expressly address cost containment strategies.
Okay, Representative Mason.
Thank you. A number of years ago, and I think it was about the middle of Governor Pawlenty's tenure, there was a major program or survey done on long-term care that I remember participating in. And the two things that I remember of the last vote was that the state could not pay for long-term care, so we needed to do something about it. So, you know, it's taken a long time, so I appreciate what you're doing. The other thing is there were some meetings after that major vote, and I remember I was attending a meeting at a nearby hotel, which we had to pay to attend, and the person from the Department of Health was apologetic, but they had no money, so they had to ask for everybody to pay so that we had a place to meet. And then there was one person at my table that said they wanted somebody to get information out about long-term care, but they didn't want it to be the insurance companies because they had a vested interest. So, I mean, it's been a long problem, and which should have been solved about 20 years ago at least. So thank you for your efforts.
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative, thank you for your comments. You know, we are really trying to get a good start on this. This is going to take years. We know it's a multi-year process, but I do think the whole education of people, making sure people understand their options, is really critical. And that's why I think having this kind of go-to place for objective, non-biased information about long-term care, much as we do in our senior linkage line, you know, is just going to be an important first step to that. And that's why I really appreciate that this creation of an information center, not a place that would sell anything or promote particular topics, but just to help people ask the right questions and make a plan, is going to be so important, both for individuals and for the state budget.
Thank you. Any follow-up, Representative Mason?
No, thank you. Unless maybe somebody would like to give a little bit more background if they remember what that study was, what it was supposed to achieve, other than the fact that we knew the state couldn't pay for it, because it involved a lot of people.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mason, you know, that happened before my time as commissioner, but I remember when I came in, I got the department gave me copies of that study, and, you know, felt that very much they put, and I think put a lot of effort into that, published some really good work on that, and then felt kind of like they weren't able to take it to the next step. So I do feel like we're able to, starting this effort, build on some good work that had gone on in, I think it was 2005 is my recollection.
Okay, thank you. Representative Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Kenvold, when I look at this suggestion, potentials with the term life insurance product that converts to a long-term care product. Are you thinking in terms of including maybe somebody who has unexpectedly had a life-threatening disease, long-term, you know, MS, you know, maybe a spinal cord injury or something? And I don't really know, I've not had any experience about, you know, what it would cost to invest in that term insurance, but I think that this would help them with long-term planning also.
Ms. Convenvold.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Keel, we do have a position paper that provides a little more depth on this product, and if we could make that available to the committee, if you would be interested. And there is, in fact, an ADL trigger that triggers the long-term care benefit. And it's based on, I believe, 2 out of 6 activities of daily living. So, indeed, it could address a disability or a chronic disease such as MS in your questioning, yes.
Representative Keel? All right, any other questions from the committee? Seeing none, Commissioner Jessen, Ms. Kvenvold, thank you for your work on this. You absolutely are doing work that other states around the country are not even coming close to. And so I want to thank you from what I understand about the group that everyone was kind of brought into the room, and there had to be agreement before we move forward with things. And so I look forward to these recommendations and further exploring them as we go through the session. And thank you for your time this morning, and thank you for your work in this.
Thank you.
All right, members, on to the other business for today. There are some corrections that need to be made to the minutes, so we'll bring those back next week to approve those then. We do have two bills up today, and if Representative Keel wants to start moving to the testifiers table, we will do that. I would remind members that the two bills up today do have a lot of tax implications with them, and would just ask the committee to please try and keep their questions to the jurisdiction of the committee here. Representative Keel, if you're ready, would you like to move House File 290?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I would like to move House File 290 and then to be referred to, I believe, taxes.
All right. Representative Keel moves House File 290 to be recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on Taxes. We have the bill before us. Representative Keel, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In thinking about how to fund long-term care, I realize that it's kind of a time in our lives when we're looking at probably raising children, working on helping them pay for college, dealing with a lot of other issues. And while I personally realize that how costly this can be, when I was taking care of my mother-in-law and my husband and I started watching all the expenses and realizing that this could affect, in our case, it was a family business, so it could affect the family business. And wanting to make sure that she got the quality care that she needed, we could not purchase long-term care at that point for her. But I was not even in my 50s. I was approaching my 50s when we sat down and talked about long-term care and the importance of it for the next generation. And wanting to be able to protect, also to protect our business for the next generation, we thought, gosh, we better do something about this. And so we've made plans. And I realize, though, in our life, what we make, I believe that we heard earlier how sometimes it's costly, and unexpected costs makes people drop their long-term care. This is... certainly, I want you to think of this, members, as a tool, not a solution, an automatic solution, because it's not something you would want to do at first glance. But this bill is to give people the option to be able to take out of their retirement before 59 and a half the ability to help pay for long-term care and or long-term care insurance. And I would be so... I would encourage people that even think about this to never think about taking all of their investments out, but to certainly help defray some of that cost. And it would be, like I said in the beginning, a tool in order to use for helping to cover long-term care. So with that, I believe I have a couple of testifiers that would like to contribute, and I don't know if you'd like to call them up now. Or
they're already on their way.
Awesome.
If you could please state your name for the record and give your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members, Toby Pearson with Care Providers in Minnesota, today on behalf of the Long-Term Care Imperative.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Carrie Thurlow with Leading Age Minnesota, also here on behalf of the Long-Term Care Imperative. Mm-hmm.
So this morning you've heard a lot about how to save, what to save, how do we plan for owning our future. As one of the participants on that little group who was in that age group where you're looking at how do you take care of your parents and how do you take care of your kids and save for college and save for your own retirement, I can tell you there were a lot of interesting conversations where we would bring it back to, okay, what are the tools and how do we need to use them? And the idea presented by Representative Keel here in this bill is just one more tool, as she said, in the toolbox that we can look at. And when we look at it from the long-term care imperative perspective, you've heard all the statistics, the 60,000 more kids than, or more seniors than kids, which is new for all of us. We also bring it back again to kind of what are our principles that we want to look at. And the principle that we found this bill falls under is helping families get prepared for the future, both financially as well as emotionally. As Representative Keel pointed out, if you have to take out money from your IRA and you're starting to be penalized in a tax form, we should do something as a state to try to help you financially make those right decisions. As she pointed out, it may not be the right case in all the time to do that, but this would be yet another tool in the toolbox for families who are facing those difficult decisions.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'll be very brief. I would echo what Mr. Pearson said, that this is another approach needed to help individuals start to plan financially for their long-term care needs. You know, the great thing about our aging population is you get to live longer, you get to enjoy life longer, but you also have a greater chance of needing long-term care services and supports as we age. And we've heard those statistics here today as well as earlier in this committee. We also know that people aren't planning and saving for their long-term care needs. And so I want to thank Representative Keel for bringing this bill forward. In studying this issue and working with groups who have tried to tackle this from a variety of ways, I think the one thing that we have learned is that one solution is not going to fit everyone's situation. People have different financial resources. They have different choices to make. And different abilities to access a variety of ways to pay for their long-term care. So this being another option to help people who might be thinking about retirement savings but not necessarily long-term care and can convert those savings to help cover the cost for services that they might need is extremely helpful. So, again, thank you, Representative Keel, for bringing this forward. And we do encourage the committee to look at this favorably. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify on House File 290? All right, seeing no one, we'll move to member questions. Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Keel, I certainly respect and agree with your desire to help people in this situation, but I do have a lot of problems with the bill. One of them is, I heard you say in your intro that this was for people who might be taking out the money to pay for their long-term care policy, but I don't see that in the bill at all. So could you just show me where I'm missing that?
Representative Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, let me ask if it's all right, Mr. Chair, Ms. Prunelli, if you could reference that for me.
Mr. Chair and Representative Keel, I think it's on page 1 in paragraph C, lines 1.14 to 1.17, where qualified long-term care expenses is defined.
Thank you.
Representative Liebling.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Okay, great. I get it now, because I was looking under the credit allowed section, and it doesn't. That's where I expected to see it. So thank you for that. Well, so Representative Keel, I guess one of the, you know, as I'm understanding this bill, and correct me if I'm wrong, what the bill does is really, you know, putting aside the long-term care policy piece, paying for your insurance, that's a piece I think I'd be fine with that, helping people pay for their insurance, which is then incentivizing them to plan for their own future. But putting that piece aside, what I really see this doing is I get that you're trying to help make it less, you're trying to give families a little more money with which to pay for these very expensive services that they need. And I think that's a great impulse, but I'm not sure that that's really the best use of our money, of our state money, because as we spend money on tax credits, and I understand this is even a refundable credit, so this could be money right out of the state treasury, we have to be thinking about what it's in competition with. If we're spending money on one thing, we can't be spending it on another. And everybody on this committee knows we've got bills going through this committee that are, you know, trying to spend a whole lot more money on the services themselves. And this one spends money on, you know, people who have assets and don't want to spend as much of them. And I don't think that's not where I would put my priority. But, you know, so we've got that. But my sort of my bigger problem with it is that I think if we're going to put money in this area, one of the things we want to do is incentivize people to take care of themselves. And that's, you know, going forward and looking at the demographics and all of this, we need people to take more of their own responsibility. And that's what we've been hearing about here. And if we just make it cheaper for them to pay when they haven't planned, I don't really see that as the right incentive. So I get that when you're at the point of that, it's like, oh my gosh, I need to take money out and I have to pay taxes or I have to pay penalties on that money that I'm taking out that I need right now. And I understand that that's not a happy situation to be in. But when we're talking about using state money to make up for federal penalties, then that's a problem for me. And I don't know how expensive this could be, but I suspect it could be very expensive for the state. So in part, I'm saying perhaps this is something that would need to be dealt with on the federal level, not the state level. And then I know this isn't the tax committee, and this will probably go through a lot more discussion, I would hope, at the tax committee before it would ever get to the floor. But I think there are a lot of real practical issues here, just application. How would this be applied? How would you, you know, how could it be, tracked, what the money's being used for, and all of that kind of thing, I think is going to create a real problem. And whenever you do that and you try to add that onto what the Department of Revenue is going to have to do, you're adding a bunch of bureaucracy, which costs you money. Mm-hmm. That, you know, takes away from, that it adds to the cost of your bill. So I just, even though I applaud your efforts here and you're trying to think of ways to deal with these things, I really don't feel like I can support the bill at this point because it just has, it's too problematic. To me, it puts money where it's not my priority for it to go. So, I maybe want to respond to some of those. I've given you an awful lot there.
Representative Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I'm going to try and respond. I might not remember everything. First of all, I would agree with you. I think we should make the step to go to the federal government and say this is a way for people to be able to pay for long-term care when they are planning. You're talking about before 59 and a half, because after 59 and a half, they can do what they want with it. However, in that 50, as we heard, the younger you purchase it, the cheaper it is, the better planning it is. And, you know, I look at, I'm not exactly sure, I should probably research this a little more, about people that realize in their genetic code they could end up with a debilitating disease. And should they plan for a long-term care, not necessarily because they're going to move into a nursing home, but because they're going to need more help at home to care, have their needs cared for. But I guess what I'm looking at is that 50 to 59-year range where, you know, you can afford to pay for some of it, you might need a little help, or you've already purchased it and something has happened and you're 57, and you need a little bit of help to pay for it at that point, rather than drop it. You've put that investment in and be able to continue it. And maybe there's insurance, as we heard today, there are some adjustments that will also be made. And granted, this is a tool. This is not for everyone, nor should it be for everyone, because as you pointed out, it could be very expensive. But I really see this as more of a middle-class tool for people that are just, you know, really having a lot of struggles. And there are some conversations here that it will be costly. I would say we still need to go and ask the federal government to consider this a deduction. Then that issue is mute then.
Follow-up, Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Keel. Well, a couple things. One is that, as I said, and I just want to reiterate, I'd have much less of an objection if it was just for buying the insurance. So that's one thing. But the other thing is, I just wanted to point out what you said about if somebody, the part you said you need to research a little bit more. As I'm understanding this insurance market, if you have something like that, they could deny you insurance. You have to be healthy when you buy this, and if you know that you have some condition. I mean, the Affordable Care Act, mm-hmm. or whatever parts of it people might not like, it said you can't be denied the right to purchase insurance because you have some pre-existing condition, right? Mm-hmm. Well, I don't think that the long-term care insurance market has that. They can deny you. They're going to underwrite it. They're going to deny you if it looks like you're going to need care. So I think that, you know, we need to keep that in mind. I assume I'm correct about that, but correct me if you know I'm wrong.
Representative Liebling, thank you for that question, Representative Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess my point was is not necessarily that you would have that disease, but that you were aware that that might be something in your genetic code as you, because I don't believe insurance requires that you say, well, you probably do say what grandma and grandpa and your siblings and all of that. I'm in trouble because diabetes is becoming a common event in my family. But that would probably be a good disease to talk about, that you might have it, you've got it under control. I don't believe that will preclude you from having long-term care insurance. However, you know you're probably going to need some type of care in the future. So,
Representative Liebling.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, actually, that would be a great question if we could bring back probably Ms. Newman just to tell us about what the long-term care, you know, what the underwriting is, because I think that's a really something that we need to understand. If you, you know, does the policy, when you buy it, require you to disclose if you know you have something, or, you know, how exactly do they handle all that? That'd be important for us to know, I think.
Welcome back, Ms. Newman.
Thank you, Chairman and legislators. Yes, when you purchase long-term care insurance, there is a health inquiry that's done. They check your medical records, and they do a personal interview, and sometimes they even do paramed exams. So, yes, you could get excluded mm-hmm. for insurance. However, on the group side, the employer marketplace does have the ability to offer insurance with much less stringent underwriting rules. So, again, if it's done at the work site and you're in your 40s, then you know, that would be the place where people could potentially get insured that they might not otherwise.
Mm-hmm. Representative Liebling.
Thank you. Thank you. And Mr. Chair, and one other follow-up about that. So if you had some genetic issue in your family and you failed to disclose that when you bought your policy, and this is something that you know, and maybe in the back of your mind, maybe in the front of your mind, that I may need, I'm going to buy this because I know that I am more likely to need some kind of care, and you don't disclose it, can your policy be canceled if the insurance company finds that out?
Representative, no. If they didn't ask the question or discover it in your health history, then you didn't do anything fraudulent. I mean, they don't go back and ask about what kind of genetic things are going on in your family. So I can't answer for the insurance industry in general, but that would be my impression of it, is that, no, if they did a full discovery when they offered the insurance, then they can't go back later and say, oh, we found something different.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you. Next, Representative Yaruso.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was going to ask about the 59 and a half to begin with. I'm glad you brought that up. So really, for the majority of people, this would only apply to the insurance premiums, since the majority of people that we're looking at would be not requiring long-term care, you know, the actual care, until after 59 and a half, hopefully for most of us. And so the care expenses would really only apply to those people that had some kind of adverse event at a younger age. But do we have other programs? Like, it's kind of leaking into taxes here, but what other things do we have where we give credits for federal tax penalties in Minnesota?
We'd have to ask
Representative Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We'd have to ask a tax expert, because I would hesitate to respond to that.
Representative Yaruso.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So that's something I'd kind of like to note for, you know, when this goes to taxes, that that comes up for discussion. Also, this applies to non-residents. What's the thinking behind that?
Representative Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you tell me where you reference that?
Mr. Chair?
Oh.
Representative Yaruso.
I see it.
Oh, she found it.
I see it. I think. Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's 1.24. Non-resident or part year resident credit may be allocated based on the percentage. I know that that was, I had some help from Mr. Michaels, and I think I'm going to ask him if he will explain that.
Briefly, Mr. Michaels, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Joel Michael from House Research. That's a standard provision in a tax credit, and the reason for it is that our income tax applies to all the income of a resident and the Minnesota income of a non-resident. And so if someone from out of state, for example, earns some money here because they worked in Minnesota or because they own property in Minnesota, they're subject to Minnesota tax, and so they would therefore qualify for this credit because we can't discriminate against non-residents. And so what this provision does is to simply say they will only get the proportion of the credit that their income, their Minnesota income, is of their total income. So, for example, if 20% of their income were subject to Minnesota tax, they would get a credit equal to 20% of what a Minnesota resident would get.
Representative Yaruso.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, in the event that a non-resident or part-year resident qualified for this, considering this is a refundable credit, is it conceivable, according to how those formulas work, that someone who's not a resident then would be receiving a refundable credit, you know, money on taxes they did not pay to Minnesota?
Mr. Michael.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Yaruso, yes, that's possible. If they, because they don't need to have Minnesota tax, but it would be in proportion to their Minnesota, to the share their Minnesota income is of their total income. If they don't have a tax liability, it's unlikely that they will even be filing a Minnesota return. But we do pay refundable credits to non-residents. So, for example, Wisconsin residents who work in Minnesota, but whose income is low enough for them to qualify for Minnesota's version of the earned income credit, they do get that. They do get that credit.
All right, Representative Yaruso, we're creeping very heavily into the tax area now.
I understand. Thank you. So the idea that this is a refundable credit concerns me on those kinds of grounds. It conceivably, the purpose behind this would be to incentivize Minnesota residents to provide for their long-term care, because it's a good idea, but also to avoid, you know, future liability for the state to pay for it. And this creates an incentive for someone who's who is a non-resident who might not otherwise have to file, to go ahead and file their taxes, even though they would owe no taxes, in order to get this refund. It's going to benefit the people at the highest end of the tax tables the most, people who pay the highest rates. Therefore, it's going to benefit the people with the highest incomes the most, and it's less likely then to benefit the people that are in the most jeopardy of ending up on state-funded long-term care. So I have some concerns about it.
Thank you, Representative Yaruso. Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Keel. It's interesting to hear this part of the discussion. I'm somewhat getting more and more interested by the day, of course. My kids are just getting to the point where they're less of an expense. College is coming to the end, so I selfishly I'm starting to think about myself. Mm-hmm. So I'm trying to get an idea around all this. I really appreciated Representative Liebling's questions about the pre-existing conditions, because we heard testimony in earlier hearings about that if once you hit 60, 90% of folks have a chronic health issue, which is clearly got to be a big, you know, you mentioned diabetes. Mm-hmm. And so there's got to be a bunch of stuff that's going on, and 90%, so pretty much everybody's got something going on. So that definitely concerns me, and I'm not sure that I just don't feel totally comfortable with the what we're hearing for the answer. But going back to the cost, and I just do you have an idea what this is, what it's going to mean, the cost for this part, the tax component of this bill that we're passing today, this section?
I did not. Excuse me, Mr. Chair.
Beal.
I did not have a financial statement done yet, so we'll have to do that and have some idea for tax committee what that would cost.
Mr. Chair and Representative Keel, so this continues to be kind of my concern. So we have the main part of the bill, which that the chair is carrying, which I support, and trying to deal with the problem around the state for nursing homes and others. And now we're kind of in the middle part of the big bill with the tax provisions, and how we get there and how we really do help folks do it, but the number just keeps growing. So we have a lot of new members here, and the realities are going to be how we pay for these things. So at one time you're cutting down, you're driving down taxes, but someone like Representative Liebling saying someone's going to pay, and then at the same time we're we've got a big bill for the nursing homes coming forward, a couple $100 million, and someone's got to pay there too. So we got to figure this out, and I'm looking forward to the tax increase bill that Representative Gunther is going to author to get this done.
Thank you, Representative Lilly. Representative Newton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm looking forward to that bill also. Mr. Chair, I have a question of Representative Keel, and that's on the credit allowed. It says an individual is allowed a credit. Does that mean that if I am incapable of paying for my own long-term care, that my daughter could use her IRA account to pay for it?
Representative Keel.
That wasn't my intent, but
certainly.
That wasn't, excuse me, Mr. Chair, that was not my plan for, anybody and everybody to take their money out, ability to take it out. It was for that person.
Hey, Mr. Chair, just to follow up, the way it's written, it would imply that anyone could take money out of their IRA to pay for the expenses of someone else. And unless that's tightened up, I don't think I can support this. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Newton. Representative Gunther.
Raising taxes isn't the most dastardly thing you can do. I understand that. But you remember, if we don't have something like this that helps out getting something like long-term care insurance, we're going to pay 50% of it anyway because it's called Medicaid. And 80% of the people in my nursing homes are getting Medicaid. So one way or the other, state tax dollars are going to pay that.
All right, seeing no more questions from members, and I'm not aware of any amendments to House File 290. Representative Keel then renews her motion that House File 290 be recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on Taxes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All those in favor of the motion, please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, same sign.
No.
The motion is approved. Thank you, Representative Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Hello, Representative Schumacher, and welcome to the committee. Would you like to move your bill, House File 921?
Yes, Madam Chair and members, I would move that House File 921 be recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on Government Operations and Election Policy.
All right, Representative Schumacher moves House File 921 to be recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on Government Operations and Elections Policy. We have the bill before us. Representative Schumacher, to your bill.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair and members. And I had prepared a few remarks for this bill, but after hearing the presentation today, my thought process kind of shifted on how we present this bill. The impetus of this came from the fact that my family runs a cleaning company, and we're looking at different products to provide for ourselves and for our employees. And so it was nice that Commissioner Jessen talked about the conversation she had with her parents, because I had a similar conversation with my parents. They were in their 40s at the time and did not appreciate that entirely. I was already planning for what they had. So we went to the insurance company and we talked about the different products that might be available for this. And as we heard from testimony from the long-term care insurance folks today and from the Own Your Future folks too, that there aren't other options out there if the long-term care insurance isn't the right fit. And that's what we found for my family and our business, what the premiums offered us and what we received in benefits or asset savings, since we're looking at saving assets of like vacuums and mops and toilet cleaner. It really wasn't in our best interest at that time to buy long-term care insurance, but there was no other avenue for us with a tax incentive to really be saving for our long-term care costs. And the fifth strategy of the Own Your Future campaign really was to produce other products that were part of that were incentivized through taxes to allow people to save in other formats. So there were other products for people to consider. So House File 921, which is part of House File 3, the bigger bill, basically sets up a health savings account for long-term care in the process. You just don't have to have a qualified insurance plan to go along with it. And it allows people to save tax-deferred up to $1,000 a year on their state taxes to start saving for this. It's $1,000 a year for single filers, $2,000 for married and joint filers. If they use the plan and it's for things that aren't long-term care expenses, there is a 10% penalty with that. There's a $200,000 contribution limit to the program over its life in the bill that's set to raise with inflation every year, so that limit would continue to go up. The other parts, and the reason that it's going to government ops next, is that that MMB is the one that really is going to set up the administrator for the plans, or allow to have other financial institutions provide deposit accounts for these plans. In looking throughout the rest of the country, when I was talking about talking with the Own Your Future and just what else is out there, I've only found two plans that other states have really gone to address. One's in Arizona, where they said any product that a financial institution sells, if you're going to use it just for long-term care insurance, you can get a tax deduction for those, and that's it. The executor on that account is the one who's in charge of making sure that happens. There's also Nebraska's plan, which this is modeled after, that had the government involved a little bit more in making sure that these were quality plans that were being sold, and that a lot more consumer protection was used within it. So that's why we have MMB involved with it. That's why the State Board of Investment is involved with it, and what we're trying to do is make sure that we have a product that is available to people that they don't have premiums, they can just make investments on their own, and that is a good quality program for people to start saving, even if they can't afford premium payments or the like. So with that, members, I will yield to questions.
Representative Urusso.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
What are the regulations for the inheritance of any remaining funds in this? How does that compare to how IRAs are inherited?
Representative Schumacher.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Yarusso. In here, if the funds are not used, they're able to be transferred to a spouse, and the funds can also be used to pay for related death expenses in there, but besides that, I'm not aware of what would happen otherwise. So I would like to call forward Mr. Michael to help me with this one.
Mr. Michael.
Madam Chair, Representative Yarusso, essentially the bill does not explicitly provide for, other than the references that Representative Schumacher made, for the inheritance of these accounts, so they would default back to the general rules under probate and so forth. You could, if the option goes that the financial institutions are providing deposit accounts, which is what's done under the Nebraska plan, then the account holders would also have the option of going through the financial institution and designating, you know, a pay on death status. If it, you know, devolved to heirs, they would then, you know, be faced with, well, do we want to withdraw this money and use it for some other purpose, in which case then the 10% penalty and regular tax would apply. But I think they would also have the option of just saying, well, I'm going to treat this as a long-term care savings account for myself and continue with it. But the bill doesn't explicitly resolve, and the Nebraska law that this is based on doesn't resolve any of those things either. I think the general presumption is that the holders will, pretty well exhaust the amounts that will be in them.
Representative Yarusso.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That may or may not be a good presumption, because part of the difficulty of all of this, as we've been hearing and some of us know, is the impossibility of predicting what any one person needs. I know that for IRAs, from personal experience, there's quite a comprehensive set of rules about how IRAs are inherited and how you continue the, you know, because it has this tax-free benefit to it. The federal government has set up a pretty comprehensive system for how that continues upon death when it's inherited by another person. And I think it would be a good idea to address that question, since if you take my parents as the example, my parents did not have long-term care insurance set up before my father would have needed it. No one would have predicted, based on their relative health going into their retirement, that my father would have been the one who would only make it to 72. So we can't predict that it would in fact be exhausted, and so I think we really need to make some provision for exactly how this would be inherited by other than the spouse, and what the tax implications of that are going to be. You know, do people just reap the benefits of this tax-free investment income, or do we deal with it? So, thank you.
Representative Schumacher, Mr. Michaels.
Okay. Just to what Mr. Michaels had said before, that if it went through as it was, the heir would have the 10% penalty unless they kept that for additional long-term care, as it is. But we'll continue to look at that. I'm open to ideas on how we make sure that those assets are protected and used the right way.
Mr. Michaels, I'm not sure if you're familiar with like an HSA, or when we first started it was an MSA. And I know, again, that's tax, you know, it has tax I'm not going to say it right. Anyway, we don't use our HSA like we did previously. But does that have the same type of, is this what that's, this is modeled after? Is the long-term care modeled a little bit at, over, a little bit with the HSAs in that, you know, what happens to that monies when something happens?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, an HSA also, if the owner of the HSA dies, there is a beneficiary that's generally has been designated, and that the beneficiary then has the option of using that HSA for qualified medical purposes, and if they do, it remains non-taxable. And so in that sense, it is similar to this. Representative Uruzzo's reference to IRAs and other qualified retirement plans do have a complicated panoply of rules that require what are called minimum distributions for people who are over 70 and a half years old. And that's intended to prevent people from using those retirement plans simply as a permanent tax-exempt asset account and require them to actually take the money out. And when you inherit those, they're a very complicated set of rules that depend upon your status and a variety of other things as to how quickly you have to take those minimum distributions that differ from people who are the actual original owner of the account as opposed to the beneficiary other than a surviving spouse. But HSAs, HRAs, which are another type of health retirement savings accounts, have separate rules that essentially, so long as the beneficiary spends it for the qualified medical purposes, it still remains tax-free, and there's not any sort of time limit that forces you to spend it within a period of time.
Thank you. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify on House File 921? Seeing none, Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to follow up with Mr. Michael before he left. Sorry, Mr. Michael. You know, I thought that was a very good question about the health savings accounts, and I just wonder, Mr. Michael, if you could sort of give us a compare and contrast. What does this bill do that people can't already get from a health savings account in terms of, you know, or I mean, maybe you can't set up your own health savings account. I'm not really sure, but could you just give us a real brief kind of comparison?
Mr. Michael.
Madam Chair, Representative Liebling, health savings accounts are intended to allow people in a sort of tax-free environment to save to pay for medical expenses, whereas this account has a slightly different focus in that it's intended to pay for not medical expenses per se, but for long-term care expenses. So you may not be paying a doctor or a nurse, but you may be paying, you know, for an attendant or living in an assisted living facility or the sort of those broader things. Now, under the Internal Revenue Code, the medical expense deduction does apply to, you know, a lot of those long-term care expenses, but health savings accounts have this sort of narrower, you know, medical expense focus on it. And generally, if you're going to use a health savings account, and I can't speak for the sponsors of this bill, but essentially you're making your health insurance decision based on that model of a health insurance system that sort of says, hey, I want to have a, you know, sort of a high deductible, a big responsibility for me to pay for those care expenses. And I would guess that the sponsors of the bill don't want to say, if you also want to independently try to save for your long-term care, that you would sort of link those two decisions together and say, gee, the only way we're going to let you save for long-term care is if you opt for the high-deductible health insurance model for your health insurance plan.
Okay.
But
Right. Representative Liebling.
Thank you for that, Mr. Michael. And that kind of, I guess, begs the question for me of whether under this bill, whether what's saved under this thing could also be used for other kinds of medical expenses. Is that, Representative Schumacher, is that allowable under this?
Representative Schumacher.
Madam Chair, Representative Liebling, it'd be my understanding that it has to be a long-term care expense, and I apologize, I'm not exactly sure what they cover. But Mr. Michael might be able to point something. I'll be a little bit more clear on that.
Madam Chair, Representative Liebling, the bill really doesn't define exactly what long-term care expenses are, whether that includes, you know, physician costs or not. It just, you know, if you look at the definition on page 1, line 11 through 13, you know, it's the cost. Some of that could be medical. Some of it could be just, you know, helping people bathe and brush their teeth and that sort of thing that's not considered to be traditional medical care, like having a physician or a nurse or something help you with. So that I would say that's sort of ambiguous under the bill.
Thank you.
Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Schumacher, the concept is really fascinating to me because I have, like, personally, I have blended genetics. So my mom died at 48, and my dad's 78, and he's going strong. So I always have a hard time of figuring out what my destiny is. So, you know, am I going to die next year, or am I going to live for a long time? So these, and I think a lot of people struggle with this. So like this, so you're going to put money, I just question whether this is really the best way, or are we better off encouraging people to put money in their investments and then have the wherewithal to you know, to spend it as their life path reveals itself? Because, you know, it sounds like it's changing. We heard testimony earlier today, and we're not exactly clear, you know, that we're all going to end up in a nursing home, or we're, you know, so we don't really necessarily know. So it's fascinating to me, and I'm definitely listening, but I was, so I'm not sure that this is really the best way. I mean, I get it. I know your intent as well are good, and I support that. And but I just question, you know, if we're better off, you know, figuring out some incentive other than this, perhaps to get folks to invest and to save. And so, anyways, and then for you freshmen, I was telling Representative Baker, it's always. I probably shouldn't give him such good advice, but I said every time Mr. Michael speaks, I said we all listen. And it's nice to hear him. He's what a gift. So, anyways, thank you.
I didn't hear a question in there.
There was not one.
Okay. So, I'm not aware of any amendments to House File 921. Is there any further discussion of the bill? And we are going to be voting in a couple minutes. Representative Newton.
Madam Chair, just a brief question. My understanding of this is that if someone like myself who already has long-term care, I wouldn't qualify under this for the a deduction. Is that correct?
Representative Schumacher.
Madam Chair, Representative Newton, that's my understanding as well. And you could use the funds that were going into this plan to pay for your premiums for long-term care insurance as well.
Representative Newton.
Madam Chair and Representative Schumacher, but would that not discourage people from taking out long-term care insurance?
Representative Schumacher.
Madam Chair, Representative Newton, I think that the attempt here and what we're trying to do is for the people who don't see long-term care insurance as the fit for them at that point in time, like in my own experiences to buy long-term care insurance for me right now, in my mind doesn't make sense. Something like this where I can set money aside so I can start planning for those long-term care expenses down the road, does make sense to me. And when there's not a premium that's set, and if you can't afford your premium because, you know, your hot water heater breaks down, you're not going to lose that. It's you're able to invest what you're able to afford, and it allows you to do that. And so it's trying to offer people who maybe can't fit into the long-term care insurance model right now, or what other products may be coming forward this year, those models, and trying to allow for a product that others can set money aside for those expenses when they come forward, instead of the option of spending down and going on MA when those costs do end up occurring.
Is there any further discussion? Hearing none, Representative Schumacher renews his motion that House File 921 be recommended to be re-referred to the Committee of Government Operations and Elections Policy. All those in favor of the motion, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, say nay. The motion does prevail. House File 921 is recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on Government Operations and Elections Policy. With that, meeting is adjourned.